This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Linda Milanese. She's executive director at Assistance Dogs of the West. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's so wonderful to see you again.
Nice to see you again. We always get together around this time of year in advance of the graduation ceremony for Assistance Dogs of the West, which this year is Tuesday, the 3rd of May at 6 o'clock at the Armory for the Arts. Now, people probably who listen to this program regularly have heard of Assistance Dogs of the West, but a lot of people still really don't know this program and what kinds of assistance these dogs are trained to give. And it turns out there's a lot of different kinds of assistance these days. You're always adding new programs.
We're always adding new programs. And we like to explain it this way. We have two different tracks. One is one dog, one person. And so those are the dogs that are mobility dogs for people with disabilities. They're medical alert dogs, such as diabetic alert dogs, seizure alert dogs. They're dogs who work with therapists in their private practice. And basically any manner of progressive disease or traumatic brain injury, with the exception of sight impaired and hearing impaired. We don't train those dogs.
So seeing eye dogs, which are probably the most familiar assistance dogs, are another thing.
They're totally trained a different way. They're trained in what's called learned disobedience. So that if you're a person who's sight impaired and you come up to a red light and you try to cross the street, the dog will block your way and not allow you to go. Whereas our dogs are trained totally on voice cues, because many people with disabilities can't manage a dog by pulling them around by a collar or snapping a choke chain or any of that. They don't have that capability. It's not our methodology of training anyhow, but our dogs are voice controlled.
Some of the people who have assistance dogs are in wheelchairs or lack mobility in one way or another, so the voice thing is what they've got.
It's really important. We've even trained dogs for, we had a little boy who had cerebral palsy and he was completely nonverbal and because of his disability. And so we trained a dog to respond to an eye gaze computer. And so we programmed in 50 cues on the eye gaze computer and the little boy would look at one of the cues and then the computer would say the cue.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Mm-hmm. The advantages of living in a technologically advanced age.
Exactly. Exactly.
So your dogs, the assistance dogs who work one-on-one with people, can do things like get food out of the refrigerator without actually eating it before it goes to its person, pick up your keys, get stuff off. Tell us.
They can definitely open up cabinets, close cabinets, pick up your keys, pick up your credit card. Bring you something, and if you're in a wheelchair, stand on the pedals of the wheelchair and actually put it in your hand. Retrieving, that's part of the reason why we use so many Labrador retrievers and Golden retrievers, because retrieving can be a big part of their life for a person with a disability, and retrievers love to retrieve.
Yeah.
So we kind of work with their natural propensity. And also, because they're very friendly and very approachable dogs, they make a nice bridge between normal functioning people and people with disabilities. People are much more likely to come up to a person in a wheelchair with a friendly lab next to them than, you know, a German Shepherd, say.
Right. Because people are a little scared of German Shepherds.
Yeah. And that's why you see a lot of the leader dogs are German Shepherds, because you actually don't want to approach that dog. That dog is a working dog, and the person, you know, wouldn't even know that you were coming up to them except by the change in the dog's behavior.
Right. So that's one kind of dog, and the sensitivity that these dogs have seems miraculous to us. I mean, the idea that a dog could alert its owner to an impending diabetes situation.
The dogs are actually so accurate. They are usually 20 minutes to a half an hour ahead of the blood glucose monitor.
And how do they know?
It's scent training. And so we train on the low scent. We get saliva samples on a cotton swab and from our diabetic clients, and we freeze them, and then we thaw them out and utilize them to train the dog that that's the scent that we want them to recognize. Separately, we train what's called an alert. Then we put the two things together, and then we train for the high. Once they get that it's scent training, they pick up on the high really quickly. And so when you think about us, we have like 240 million, I think, scent receptors, and dogs have over 600 million with a special turbocharge that's right in the front of their brain that brings all that scent up in very specific ways. And so they can determine that the blood glucose level is moving far quicker than the blood glucose monitor.
Another program that you have is courthouse dogs, and this is something other than one dog for one person. These dogs work with a lot of different people.
Yes, throughout the course of their career, they might help thousands of people. And the courthouse dogs work with professionals in the judicial system. It can be a district attorney, it can be a special victims advocate, it can be at a child advocacy center, it can be at CASA, any situation where you have people working in the investigation and prosecution of crime. These dogs are available to help the victims, particularly vulnerable victims like children. They work with a lot of children. And because we have such a varied student training program, our dogs are brought up their entire lifetime working with kids. And so they're very fluent in their behavior, in being polite around children. They don't knock children over. So they're just an incredible resource for people who are trying to, for instance, have a child disclose what happened to them,
right?
Which can re-traumatize a person. Part of what happens during the investigation and prosecution of crime is that the child needs to disclose what happened to them. And so that experience can be re-traumatizing as if it happened a second time.
Right.
And so the dogs really mediate that situation, especially in forensic interviews.
So basically, there will be a forensic interview, which is in a room with two-way mirrors and police people, sometimes in uniforms and tables, and all of that might be a really scary situation for a person, for a young person especially, for anybody. And then they get to, what, pat the dog? Have
Yes.
dog around, like have their arms around the dog?
Sure. And we teach a special cue, which is called visit. And the dog actually learns how to lay their head in the child's lap or lay their head on the child's thigh if they would like that. We also teach the forensic interviewers, we teach them some basic navigational cues because a child might not want the dog's head near them, but might like the dog up on the couch with the head facing out. Or they might like the dog on a bed on the floor by the couch. So it really depends on what the child needs.
Then there is the whole part that happens in a courthouse. I mean, they're called courthouse dogs, although that's not all they do.
So it may take 2 to 3 years before a case goes to mediation or to trial. If the case goes to trial, the handlers and the dogs are actually trained to be present in the courtroom. And state by state, the regulations of what the dogs can do in the courtroom is different. In the state of California, the special victims advocate is actually allowed to be on the stand with the child sitting behind the child, and the courthouse dog is allowed to be laying down right in front of the child. And if you think about the witness box, the dog is not actually visible, but the special victim's advocate can be right up there with them. In many of the courthouses and courtrooms in New Mexico, they can only be in line of sight. And so the child will be on the stand, and the special victim and the dog are positioned. We work in the courtrooms with them to determine where the best positioning would be so that they can be in line of sight of the child.
And so the dog doesn't, I mean, the person doesn't actually get to touch the dog, but still, many of us who are dog people, you know how you feel when the dog enters the room. It lowers your blood pressure instantaneously.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. A dog at rest lets you feel that you are safe.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly what happens with the children and other victims. It's not just children, but it is often a lot of domestic violence and sexual abuse towards children.
We're talking to Linda Milanese of Assistance Dogs of the West. There's some more recently added programs that are fascinating. One of them is called Warrior Canine Connection. Tell us about that.
So the Warrior Canine Connection originated at Walter Reed.
Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C.
Yes. Our colleague Rick Yount began the program. And when we decided that we wanted to work with veterans because we had a colleague who had such a successful program, we went and Jill and I went and visited with him, and we decided that that was the way that we wanted to roll out the program. And basically, it is veterans in our program, it's veterans of all different combats who learn to train the service dogs as part of their non-pharmaceutical therapy for traumatic brain injury, PTSD, combat injuries. There is a great complexity about what happens when people have been in combat. They've been trained very rigorously to be able to go and fight. And when they come back, they actually need to be retrained, so to speak, to be able to integrate back into society.
And to not fight and to not see the world as potential enemy and all that.
Yeah. And so training dogs really helps to mediate all of that learning. They learn emotional modulation. They learn positive reinforcement. They learn consistency. They learn emotional regulation. They learn peer-to-peer mentoring. And what we found, because our program is in a class situation, we have veterans from Vietnam, Persian Gulf, Iraq, Afghanistan. And normally these folks would not really have anything in common, or they would think that they didn't have anything in common because of age, because of the difference in the actual combat experience. The dogs are the equalizer. They're all novice trainers. And yeah. So they're all going to hit the bumps in the road from being novice trainers. And so they learn to help each other, and they actually have become friends. And it's an outcome that Walter Reed doesn't see, because those are warriors in transition. They're not actually veterans yet because they're in the hospital setting. And so it's more of a one therapist, one trainer, one warrior in transition. So what happens in a group is unique to what's going on here in New Mexico. And Walter Reed is very, very interested in the outcomes.
What's the long-term plan for the dog-human relationship in that case?
Ultimately, those dogs get placed, hopefully, with veterans, not exclusively with veterans. But this year at our graduation, we will have two of the first graduating dogs that were trained by the veterans who are actually going to be the people who receive the dogs.
So these warriors are training dogs that they will get. They're also training dogs that other people will get.
Yep. They might go to another veteran, not for them. They might go to another veteran. We just had an interview with a fellow who was in Afghanistan, a very likely candidate. He is not in the program where he is an actual trainer, but he could easily be a recipient of one of the dogs that was trained by another veteran. Two of the other dogs that are graduating this year, which are the crisis response canines for the FBI, were trained by the Warrior Canine Connection. They were trained by our veterans.
There's something I wanted to ask you about. I adore dogs. It's probably a should be a mental illness. I love them so much. But, you know, there are some people who really don't like dogs at all. I have a close friend who got a dog for her kids, and the dog has totally fallen in love with her, and she's sort of indifferent to it. And that's the way life is. Not everybody loves dogs. Not everybody loves spinach. I mean, but people who work with dogs, do they have to pretty much be in that group that has a natural affinity for dogs?
Well, a natural affinity to me kind of presumes that they might have, quote unquote, a talent or something for dogs. I think just a basic relationship with them. We train a lot of different populations. We have elementary school kids, middle school kids, kids with disabilities, high school kids, veterans, and all these different populations learn how to train dogs. And so there's something quite magical that happens during that process, but I don't think that you necessarily have to have a talent for it. Some people are better, some people are not so skilled, but you benefit from it anyway, because it's unconditional love. It's a level of consistency. It's, as we talked about before, emotional regulation. You can't train a dog unless you're able to bring your emotions up or bring your emotions down, depending on what the particular situation would call for.
Tell us more about the FBI Dogs program.
So for the first time in the history of the FBI has many dogs. They have bomb-searching dogs. They have cadaver dogs. For the first time in their history, in the Office of Special Victims Assistance, they have engaged in crisis response canines. And we placed those dogs with them in October. They are joining us for graduation. They are part of our graduating class this year. And these dogs are used to help victims in major traumatic criminal events, such as San Bernardino. The dogs, they are part of a rapid deployment team. They work with the special victims handlers and first responders. They were flown out to San Bernardino. We have two dogs in the San Bernardino District Attorney's Office, and so we put them all together, and so all four dogs were able to work as part of that incident.
What did they do?
Well, this office in the FBI sets up all the services for the victims. So whether it's visitations in the hospitals, or it's death notifications, or it's people don't know whether someone is alive or dead, or people who are, for instance, one of the things that that the district attorney's office shared with me, many of the people who worked at that place weren't at the party, and so they had to go back to work without many of their colleagues being there. And so it's other employees, it's families of the employees. It impacts so many people, and so the dogs are there to really help mediate all of that trauma.
So people go back to work after the San Bernardino massacre. Their friends are now dead. They go to work, and there's these dogs.
I'm not sure whether the dogs actually went back to their work, but they could very well have gone back to their work. I know when we were involved in the Berendo Middle School shooting, the days when the children went back to school, the dogs were actually there and actually sat at the desks of the children who were shot. So they laid on the floor by those empty desks.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm not positive about San Bernardino, but it would be likely that that could easily happen. That could be one of the things that could happen, yes.
These traumatic events are far more common than we would like them to be, and so there's probably a lot of work for those dogs. Nevertheless, they don't happen every day. What do those dogs do the rest of the time? I mean, working dogs want a job.
They go to work every day. And even though they are part of this particular aspect of the FBI, what we learned is there is a lot more that goes on than what we probably as civilians imagine. And so these dogs actually perform a lot of staff care. There are people who are working on hostage situations, on criminal events all over the globe. It is fast-paced. It is super, super stressful. People's lives are in the balance. And these people who, they are exceptional, exceptional people who do this work. And so the dogs are there to help them. We have a video from the assistant director because she can't be there in person. And one of the things that she says in the video is it's so heartwarming to see a 6'5" agent with guns on his belt and rolling around on the floor with the black Labrador and laughing and being, you know, really happy.
Now, you always use Labradors pretty much, or do you use other kinds as well?
We do a lot of Labradors. We also do Golden Retrievers. One of the dogs that is graduating this year is an Australian Shepherd. She's a diabetic alert dog. We have some standard poodles right now in our program. But we use a lot of retrievers because, as I said, part of what their jobs are when they go to people with disabilities is retrieving.
And then there's that poodle retriever mix, which is so popular now, the doodle.
Yeah, the labradoodle.
Yeah, labradoodles and golden doodles. And how do you select what dogs are really suitable to be assistance dogs? I mean, do they have to be big? Do you do like some kind of temperament testing when they're puppies?
So it's a rather complex process. Number one, the first thing is genetics and breeding. These are what are called purpose-bred dogs. And they're bred first for health and for genetic propensity to health. Some of the lines that we work with, we have 75 years of genetic information. So before a dog is ever bred into our program, they have heart tests, eye tests, elbows, hips, yeah. all the things that we can determine our best shot for a healthy dog.
Now, isn't that an issue with golden retrievers who've been so perhaps overbred in this country or anywhere?
It's a very big issue for golden retrievers. We have a hard time finding golden retrievers that don't have cancer in the line.
Oh,
which
boy.
That's one of the biggest liabilities with golden retrievers. We do have some. We've been lucky to find, but it took Jill, our founder, I think it took her 3 or 4 years before she actually found a line that was cancer-free and also had longevity in it, where the mom lived to be 15 years old, 16 years old. So health is a big aspect because, of course, if you get a service dog, you want to be able to have a working life with them for as long as possible. Temperament is another big aspect, and we do a very complex temperament scoring. We don't really do what's called testing, quote-unquote, because there's no good dog, bad dog. It's are dogs suitable for being work dogs, and do they have a propensity to be wheelchair dogs, or do they have a propensity to be an alert dog?
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's just, I mean, it's so interesting to me that just as we humans have personalities that are suited for different lines of work, so do dogs, even within the same breed.
Oh, most definitely. And they exhibit that very early on. We do our temperament scoring. Sometimes we'll do temperament scoring at 10 weeks old. And then we'll do another one maybe when they're, say, 6 or 7 months old. And you will see that, for instance, cadence. Does the dog walk in the room? Does they trot into the room? Do they run into the room? you will see that that cadence generally stays with a dog for their entire life.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So there are important qualities. For instance, a medical alert dog, you want a dog that has more prey drive than a courthouse dog. You want a courthouse dog that's going to choose to stay with the handler rather than, you know, go. We have a prey aspect of the test where a fur hat goes flying across the floor, and does the dog go chase the hat or does the dog stay with the handler?
Yeah.
And so it's important qualities that are observed.
And these dogs are trained by you guys and by students. We had students from Desert Academy and other schools here in the past.
So the professional trainers set the cues on the dogs, and we have various student populations that reinforce those cues under the directions of the professional trainers, who are also teachers. So they teach the kids, they train the dogs. We have some students who stay with us for a number of years. We have some students who started in elementary school will stay with us throughout their entire high school career. I think you met one of them at another time, Jenny Reichert. She's going off to college next year. So those students become really proficient trainers. And so they actually will be given puppies to actually set the cues on them and shape the behaviors.
So graduation is coming up. It's Tuesday, May 3rd at 6 in the evening at the Armory for the Arts. The tickets are highly affordable and can be procured at the Lensic box office at ticketsantafe.org and at 988-1234. What happens at the graduation?
Well, the thing that's most moving about graduation, there are a lot of different aspects, and one of the most lovely is that Allie McGraw is our MC this year, and we love her, and we're very fortunate that she'll be with us. The most moving piece of it is the student trainers who have worked with the dogs, most often for a year, they officially hand the dog over to the client. And it's really very moving because they get to say a little bit about the dog and about training the dog. And they do that very important task of loving something and then giving it away because the dog is going to do something greater than just them.
Yeah.
And that's a really, really big deal. These kids are amazing. And then, of course, the recipients, they are deeply moved to meet their student trainers, to meet the people who have really influence the training of their dog. And they usually talk a little bit about how the dog has changed their lives already.
AssistanceDogsOfTheWest.org is the website. Linda Milanese is the executive director. Once again, Tuesday, the 3rd of May, and I've been, it's an absolutely wonderful experience. You guys do an incredible job, and thanks for being here, and thanks for all the work you do with your animals.
And thank you. It's always so great to see you. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.